You know, usually when we look at massive steel structures, I mean, think of a suspension bridge or a skyscraper or even the hull of a cargo ship, we just see this impenetrable, uniform monolith of strength. It's solid, it's permanent.
Right, it feels like one continuous, unchanging material.
Yeah.
The macro world, it kind of tricks us into thinking steel is just, steel.
Yeah, but then you zoom in, you pull out a microscope, and you look at the atomic level, especially right where two pieces of metal have been welded together, and suddenly that solid monolith just disappears. We're looking at a landscape that is, well, honestly, it's a war zone.
It really is. It is the absolute definition of a microscopic turf war. What looks solid to us is actually this chaotic battlefield of growing crystals, all competing for space and resources in the very few seconds it takes for molten metal to cool.
So, welcome to today's deep dive. We are going to explore exactly that microscopic battlefield. Today, we're looking at a really fascinating discovery made by metallurgists at Cambridge University back in 1990.
Yes, this is the research by SS Babu and HKDH Badesia. And they basically figured out how to manipulate this turf war to build a better, stronger steel weld.
And the paper is titled "Transition from Bainite to a Siccular Ferrite in Reheated FCRC Weld Deposits," which I know is a mouthful.
It is, yeah. The paper itself is highly specific to a certain type of industrial welding, but the core narrative, I mean, it's really a story of manipulation. It's about how to control a chaotic environment.
Exactly. Our mission today is to decode how engineers manipulate metal at the very atomic level to make strong, resilient welds by controlling exactly where and how these tiny crystals grow.
Because if you can control the micro, you control the macro.
Right. And even if you aren't a material scientist, even if you've never held a welding torch in your life, this deep dive is a masterclass in how tiny, invisible, upstream changes completely dictate the world around you.
We're really looking at reverse engineering a desired outcome. When you want a specific result at the end of a process, sometimes you don't fight the final stage. You go, all the way back to the beginning and tweak the starting conditions.
So, to get into this, we need to introduce the two main combatants in this microscopic turf war. Because when a steel weld cools down from a liquid into a solid, the atoms organize themselves into different crystalline structures.
Or phases, as metallurgists call them.
Phases, right. And in the specific type of steel we're talking about, there are two primary structures fighting for dominance. So let's start with the villain of our story, at least in this context, which is bainite.
Bainite. Okay, so to understand bainite, picture the hot steel just before it fully cools. At very high temperatures, the steel exists in a phase called austenite.
Okay, austenite.
Right. It's made up of distinct microscopic grains. You can think of these grains like bubbles in foam all pressed up against each other. The borders where these grains meet are called grain boundaries.
And from what I understand, these boundaries are crucial real estate.
Oh, they are. They're high energy zones. Because the atomic structure is a little chaotic, right, where two grains meet, it takes much less energy for a new crystal to start forming there.
So it's the easy path.
Exactly. And bainite loves the path of least resistance. It always nucleates or, starts growing right at those austenite grain boundaries. And when it grows, it forms in these parallel plates.
Kind of like a stacked deck of cards, just these straight parallel lines stacked neatly on top of each other, pushing inward from the edges of the grain.
That's a really good way to visualize it.
Yeah.
And that stack structure is exactly why engineers don't want too much bainite in a weld.
Because it's weak.
Well, imagine a microscopic crack forming in the steel under stress. If it hits that deck of cards, it just slides right between the parallel plates. The structure doesn't offer much physical resistance, so the crack propagates easily, and, well, the weld fails.
Wow, okay. Which means we need a structure that does offer resistance. And that brings us to the other fighter in this war, a siccular ferrite.
Yes. This is the structure engineers desperately want to see when they look under the microscope.
And why is that? How is it different from the deck of cards?
A siccular ferrite is highly desired because it grows completely differently. Instead of starting at the easy grain boundaries, it nucleates inside the grain.
Wait, it just starts in the middle of nowhere?
Not nowhere, exactly. It finds tiny non-metallic impurities, we call them inclusions, like little specks of oxide floating in the steel, and it uses those as seeds to start growing.
Okay. And because these inclusions are scattered randomly throughout the center of the grain, the crystals grow in every which direction. It's not a neat stack of cards at all.
No, it's chaotic. It forms this interlocking basket weave structure.
A microscopic woven mesh. So if I imagine that same crack trying to travel through the metal now.
Instead of sliding between parallel plates, it hits this chaotic basket weave. The crack has to constantly change direction, twisting and turning, bouncing off crystals oriented in a dozen different directions.
And that just burns up all the crack's kinetic energy, right?
Exactly. The acicular ferrite stops cracks in their tracks. It makes the weld incredibly tough and resilient.
So the goal is simple. Get less of the stacked cards, the bainite, and more of the basket weave, the acicular ferrite.
That is the goal, yes.
Which brings us to a massive anomaly that Babu and Videshia highlight in their research. To make steel stronger, we often add alloying elements, heavy hitters like chromium and molybdenum.
Right. Standard practice in metallurgy.
But the paper points out that when they added these elements to the weld deposits, the amount of that good basket weave structure mysteriously dropped. Suddenly, the welds were dominated by the brittle, stacked card bainite.
It's a hugely frustrating paradox for metallurgists. When you add premium ingredients to improve the recipe, and the final product comes out worse.
Right. I'm really stuck on this. Wait, if we're adding heavy hitter elements like chromium and moly specifically to upgrade the steel, why are those exact ingredients sabotaging the physical structure and giving us bainite? It seems totally backward.
It feels incredibly counterintuitive. But that's until you realize that metallurgy isn't just about what ingredients are in the pot. It's about the sequence of events as the pot cools.
The timeline.
Exactly. Chromium doesn't actually attack the acicular ferrite. It alters the thermodynamic timeline of the cooling metal. Adding those alloys accidentally suppresses a crucial third player in the metal.
A third player? But wait, if chromium stops the acicular ferrite, what is it actually doing at the atomic level? Are you saying it targets something else entirely?
Yes, it does. To understand why chromium ruins the acicular ferrite, we have to look at what happens in a normal, low-alloy steel weld just moments before the bainite tries to form.
Okay, take me to that moment.
So as the hot austenite starts to cool, the very first phase to form isn't bainite or acicular ferrite. It's a phase called allotriomorphic ferrite.
Allotriomorphic ferrite. That's a bit of a tongue twister. Okay, what is that doing?
Its role is absolutely vital. It forms as a thin, continuous layer right along those original austenite grain boundaries. It basically coats the edges of the grains before anything else has a chance to grow.
Oh, I see. And Babu and Padesia looked at this and proposed a really clever hypothesis. They realized that bainite needs those grain boundaries to start its growth.
Right, because it's lazy. It wants the easiest starting point.
But if this allotriomorphic ferrite forms there first, it essentially paves over the prime real estate. The boundaries are just blocked.
Denied their preferred starting point at the edges, the structural transformation is forced to look elsewhere. The cooling metal still has this massive thermodynamic drive to change its crystal structure.
It has to transform into something.
Yes. But since the boundaries are blocked, the only other place to start growing is inside the grain, on those tiny impurity inclusions we talked about.
And what grows from the inclusions? The acicular ferrite, the basket weave. So this thin layer of allotriomorphic ferrite acts as a physical barrier.
That's the theory, yes.
It blocks the bainite, which inadvertently forces the highly desirable acicular ferrite to form. So it's kind of like a bouncer at a club.
A bouncer, I like that.
Yeah, like the grain boundary is the door. If the bouncer is standing there, the bainite can't get in, so the party is forced to happen in the middle of the room.
That's a very useful way to look at it.
But adding chromium, what, fires the bouncer?
Pretty much. Mm-hmm. Chromium basically delays the bouncer from showing up to work. Elements like chromium and molybdenum change the kinetic timeline of the steel. They slow down the reaction rates for certain phase changes.
Oh, so the timing is off.
Exactly. So as the weld is rapidly cooling down to room temperature, the allotriomorphic ferrite just doesn't have enough time to form. The temperature drops past its preferred window before it can get organized.
So the bouncer never shows up, and the grain boundaries are left completely naked.
Naked and vulnerable. And bainite, taking the path of least resistance, immediately claims that space. It floods the grain boundaries, grows its parallel plates inward, and just completely takes over the microstructure.
Wow. The acicular ferrite never even gets a chance because the bainite consumes all the available space and energy?
Exactly.
Okay, that is a brilliant hypothesis. The bouncer prevents the bad structure and forces the good structure. But, you know, in science, a hypothesis is just a nice story until you prove it.
Right, you need evidence.
And proving a negative, proving that the absence of this microscopic bouncer is the direct culprit for the ruined steel, that requires a seriously clever experiment. I mean, you can't just mix up a batch of high chromium steel, weld it, and point to the result. You have to isolate the variables.
You have to prove that if you somehow force the bouncer to show up in a high chromium steel, the acicular ferrite will return.
So how did Babu and Hideyoshi pull this off? From the paper, it looks like they didn't just weld two massive plates of metal together in a shipyard. They took this into the lab with incredible precision.
They really did.
They machined these tiny 3-millimeter cylinders of a specific high alloy weld metal, one containing exactly 1.59% chromium, and they put these tiny cylinders into a machine called a dilatometer.
Ah, the dilatometer. It is the unsung hero of material science. It is an instrument specifically designed to measure microscopic changes in length and volume as a material undergoes thermal cycles.
But wait, how do they actually, see what's happening inside a solid piece of glowing hot metal? You can't exactly look through a microscope at 800 degrees Celsius while the crystal structures are shifting.
No, you can't. And that's the absolute genius of dilatometry. You don't need to see the crystals. You just need to feel them moving.
Feel them moving. I mean, it's a solid piece of steel.
It is solid, but the atomic structure is shifting. Remember that hot phase we talked about, austenite?
Yeah.
Its atoms are arranged in what's called a face-centered cubic structure. It's very densely packed. But when it transforms into ferrite, the atoms rearrange into a body-centered cubic structure, which is slightly less densely packed. It actually takes up a little more room.
Oh, wow. So as the crystal structure changes, the metal actually physically expands.
Yes, it expands. Even as the metal is cooling down, which, normally causes things to shrink, the phase change from austenite to ferrite causes this sudden microscopic expansion.
That's wild.
And the dilatometer is equipped with these incredibly sensitive sensors. They usually use lasers or precise quartz push rods that measure these changes in length down to the micrometer.
Wow.
So as the researchers change the temperature of the sample in the machine, they can watch the length of the cylinder change in real time. By tracking those tiny expansions, they know exactly when a new phase starts growing, how fast it's growing, and when it stops.
Okay, so they have this incredibly precise monitoring system. How do they use this machine to trap the metal into doing what they want? I mean, how do they force this banter to appear?
Well, they designed a very clever two-step heat treatment. They basically engineered a thermal obstacle course for this high chromium steel.
Okay, what was step one?
Step one, they heated the samples up to a very high temperature, well into the austenite phase, and then they rapidly cooled them down to about 700 or 800 degrees Celsius and just held them there for several minutes.
Wait, why hold it there? Normally, a weld just cools straight down to room temperature, doesn't it?
It does, and that's the trap. Remember, chromium slows down the reaction kinetics. That suppresses a bouncer from forming during a normal continuous cooling process because the metal just cools too fast for it to take hold.
Right, the bouncer doesn't have time to show up.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But by stopping the cooling process and holding the metal at 700 degrees, which is a temperature where only yellowtrium morphic ferrite can form, they gave it enough time to overcome the kinetic delay caused by the chromium.
Oh, they forced the bouncer to line the grain boundaries?
Yes, they artificially decorated the edges of the grains with our bouncer layer. Then comes step two.
Right. So once they knew from the dilatometer's expansion readings that the thin layer had formed, they rapidly dropped the temperature down to around 500 degrees Celsius.
And this is the danger zone.
The danger zone.
Yeah, this is the exact temperature where bainite normally goes crazy and takes over.
The moment of truth. If the bouncer works, the bainite shouldn't be able to form, even at its absolute favorite temperature. So what happened when they pulled these samples out and looked at them under the electron microscope?
The trick worked perfectly. The high chromium samples that were given this two-step treatment, the ones where the bouncer was forced to form, produced beautiful, intricate, intragranular acicular ferrite.
The basket weave.
The basket weave is back. And as a control, they took samples of the exact same metal and cooled them directly down to 500 degrees, completely skipping the first step.
And what happened to those?
They formed classical brittle bainite.
That is just incredible. They proved that the chromium wasn't inherently poisoning the acicular ferrite. It was just leaving the door open for bainite by delaying the bouncer. By manually closing the door, the good structure flourished.
It's a complete triumph of experimental design.
Mm.
But the paper actually goes a layer deeper because the question remains, why does the bouncer work? Is it just a physical wall? Like literally just a layer of atoms in the way?
Right, because if it's just a wall, couldn't the bainite just start growing on top of the bouncer? I mean, it's still basically the edge of the grain. What's stopping it from just building off the yellowtriomorphic ferrite?
This is where Babu and Padacia bring in the heavy mathematical artillery. They proved it's not just a physical wall. It is an invisible chemical force field.
An invisible force field. The paper dives into the finite difference method to calculate carbon concentrations to explain this. So break this down for us. What is happening chemically when this bouncer, this allotriomorphic ferrite, forms?
Well, it comes down to solubility. Austenite, which is the high-temperature parent phase, can dissolve a fair amount of carbon within its crystal lattice.
Okay, so it holds carbon well.
Right. But ferrite cannot hold much carbon at all. It just doesn't have the room in its structure. So as the allotriomorphic ferrite grows along the grain boundary, it has to get rid of the carbon that was originally in that space.
Where does it go?
It physically rejects the carbon atoms. It pushes them out into the surrounding austenite phase just ahead of the growing crystal.
So wait, as the ferrite grows, it's shoving the carbon out of the way, kind of like, I don't know, a snowplow pushing a drift ahead of it.
Yeah.
So you end up with a massive snowbank of carbon right in front of the boundary.
That is the fundamental mechanism, yes. A chemical snowplow.
Wow.
As the thin layer of ferrite grows inward from the boundary, it pushes a wave of carbon ahead of it. The paper uses the finite difference method to track this exactly. Essentially, it models how those carbon atoms diffuse, or rather, fail to diffuse quickly enough, into the center of the grain.
They just get backed up.
Exactly. They calculated exactly how big that snowbank gets, and they found that the austenite, immediately adjacent to the bouncer, becomes incredibly enriched with carbon.
So you have this localized traffic jam of carbon atoms right where the bainite wants to start growing. But why does a high concentration of carbon stop the bainite?
Because bainite is incredibly sensitive to carbon concentration. For a phase transformation to occur, it has to be thermodynamically favorable.
There has to be enough chemical driving force.
Exactly. The researchers proved that this carbon snowbank becomes so concentrated that it essentially rewrites the thermodynamic rules for that specific localized area.
Meaning the temperature requirements change.
Yes, drastically. The carbon saturation pushes the required temperature for bainite to form well below the actual temperature of the metal in the furnace.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so even though the overall piece of metal is sitting at 500 degrees, which is normally prime territory for bainite, the localized carbon enrichment right at the boundary lowers the transformation temperature so much that 500 degrees is suddenly no longer cold enough to trigger the bainite.
So it becomes physically impossible for it to nucleate there. It's chemically starved out of its preferred real estate.
Precisely.
So the bouncer isn't just standing at the door. The bouncer has flooded the entrance with a chemical deterrent that makes the bainite not even want to approach the door.
It's a localized force field.
Yeah.
And because the bainite is fundamentally blocked by thermodynamics, the transformation is just delayed. The metal sits there, wanting to change phase to reach equilibrium, but unable to start at the edges.
And it has to do something.
Right. Eventually, the thermodynamic pressure builds up, the temperature drops a bit more, and the metal is forced to use the only available nucleation sites left.
The inclusions in the center of the grains.
Yes. And so the acicular ferrite is born.
This is just brilliant. It is such an elegant piece of detective work. I mean, they saw an anomaly, right? Adding good alloys caused a bad outcome. They hypothesized a missing link, the missing bouncer at the grain boundary. They engineered a way to trap the metal and force the bouncer to appear. And then they did the math to prove exactly how the bouncer's carbon snowplow created an invisible force field.
It really is a masterpiece of metallurgical research. By understanding this exact mechanism, you know, the competition for grain boundary space and the chemical snowplow effect, engineers don't just have to accept whatever structure the metal decides to give them.
They aren't at the mercy of the cooling curve.
Not at all. They can intentionally design heat treatments or adjust alloy compositions specifically to trick the metal into forming the stronger, tougher structure. They are manipulating matter at the atomic level to build a safer macro world.
It's a brilliant example of reverse engineering a problem. And I think that's the ultimate application for you listening to this right now. The principles here go way beyond metallurgy.
Oh, absolutely.
When a system isn't yielding the results you want, sometimes you don't fight the main event. You don't just yell at the bainite for ruining your steel.
You have to look upstream. You find the path of least resistance that the negative outcome is exploiting.
You block the easy path to force a better, more resilient outcome. You engineer the starting conditions so that the result you want becomes the only viable option.
It's about setting up the environment for success, rather than trying to brute force the final result at the end of the line.
So as we wrap up this deep dive into the microscopic turf wars of steel, think about the systems you manage at work or the processes you build. Are you constantly fighting fires at the end of the line? What happens if you go upstream and block the easy path to failure?
Yeah, where are you getting suboptimal, brittle results in your projects simply because you haven't put a strategic bouncer at the door?
It's definitely something to consider next time you find yourself trying to fix a problem that's already halfway through the door. The macro is just the micro, scaled up. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.